From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The metal band Metallica, the biggest selling rock act of the 90s, has survived for 23 years. A new book about the band called So What has just been published. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Metallica singer and guitarist James Hetfield about the history of the band and what it's like now that he's entering middle age. We'll also talk about the anger and exhaustion that recently threatened to break up Metallica. This period was chronicled in the documentary Some Kind of Monster. It opened over the summer. Also, critic Milo Miles reviews several new collections of music from Bollywood, India's film industry. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer. Two members of President Bush's cabinet, Attorney General John Ashcroft and Commerce Secretary Donald Evans, have resigned. The White House says President Bush accepted their resignations today. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
In a handwritten letter dated November 2nd, Election Day, Ashcroft said the demands of justice are both rewarding and depleting, and that, in his words, the Department of Justice would be well served by new leadership and fresh inspiration. In his letter, Evans, a former fundraiser for the president, said he has concluded with deep regret that it is time to return home. The resignations are the first since the president's reelection. It was widely expected that Ashcroft would be ending his controversial tenure at the Justice Department. In his letter, Ashcroft wrote that the objective of securing the safety of Americans from crime and terror has been achieved. More cabinet shuffling is likely in the days ahead. Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson has made it known he would like to leave before the president's second term begins. Brian Naylor, NPR News, The White House.
President Bush says the U.S. troops in Fallujah are doing what he called the hard work of building a free Iraq. The president went to Walter Reed Army Hospital in Washington today to visit wounded soldiers. More than 8,000 U.S. forces have been wounded in Iraq. More than 1,100 U.S. troops have died there since the war began. The U.S. military says 10 U.S. troops and two Iraqi security forces have been killed in the U.S.-led offensive in Fallujah, Iraq. An undisclosed number have been wounded. A senior military commander in Iraq says U.S. troops are meeting resistance in Fallujah. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Lieutenant General Thomas Metz predicted several more days of tough urban fighting to retake the insurgent-held city of Fallujah. Speaking to reporters in a video conference from Iraq, he said that U.S. troops have captured a small number of enemy fighters and have killed or wounded a significant number of insurgents.
The fight in Fallujah is far from over. We are proceeding with speed, not haste, to maintain the initiative. And we are using caution and precision in order to minimize civilian casualties and damage to the city.
General Metz acknowledged that the offensive has led to an increase in attacks elsewhere in Iraq, but he claimed U.S. troops were prepared for that. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, The Pentagon.
Sudan today signed peace agreements with rebels. The deals are aimed at ending hostilities in the Darfur region and guaranteeing that aid workers have free access to refugees. Sudan has also agreed to allow no-fly zones to be created over Darfur. On Wall Street today, the Dow closed down 5 points at 10,386. The Nasdaq closed up 4 points. This is NPR News. A new study finds that people with heart disease benefit from a drug that lowers blood pressure, even if their blood pressure isn't high to start with. NPR's Richard Knox reports.
Nobody had ever studied whether blood pressure drugs could help heart disease patients with only modestly elevated blood pressure. The answer is yes, according to a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Researchers gave 2,000 patients with known heart disease a drug called amlodipine, another one called enalapril, or a placebo. After 2 years, both drugs lowered blood pressure equally to only 124 over 76. But those taking amlodipine were 31% less likely than those on enalapril to have a heart attack or need hospital care for a cardiovascular problem. The authors say it will take more research to know if all heart patients should get their blood pressure down to such low levels. The study was funded by the maker of amlodipine. Richard Knox, NPR News.
Most large U.S. airlines are going to start testing their water more often and disinfecting aircraft water storage and delivery systems after a government study this summer found coliform bacteria in the drinking water in one of every 8 planes tested. New guidelines have been issued requiring closer monitoring. The nation's biggest insurance broker says it will lay off 3,000 workers in the wake of a bid rigging investigation by New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. Marsh & McLennan says its third quarter earnings fell 94%. The company says about 3/4 of the job cuts will come from the Marsh Risk and Insurance Services Unit. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The band Metallica, the biggest-selling rock act of the 90s, has survived for 23 years. My guest is singer and guitarist James Hetfield, one of the founders of the band. As the Rolling Stone Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll says, after gaining a solid cult following among fans who could not identify with contemporary pretty boy pop metal combos such as Van Halen and Bon Jovi, Metallica became known for its sophisticated, often complex song structure and serious lyrics that reflected teen obsession with anger, despair, fear, and death. An illustrated book about the band has just been published called So What? The Good, the Mad, and the Ugly. In January, the acclaimed Metallica documentary, Some Kind of Monster, will be released on DVD. It chronicled the making of their album, Saint Anger, and the anger, tension, and exhaustion that nearly broke up the band as the members neared middle age. The band actually hired a therapist to conduct group therapy sessions. During this period, Hetfield checked himself into rehab. When he emerged, Metallica completed Saint Anger. Here's a song from it called Some Kind of Monster.
These are the legs in circles run. This is the beating you'll never know. These are the lips that taste no freedom. This is the feel that's not so safe. This is the face you'll never change. This is the God that ain't so pure. This is the God that is not pure. This is the voice of silence no more. Some kind of monster. Some kind of monster. Some kind of monster. This monster lives.
James Hetfield, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start at the beginning of Metallica's history. What did you want Metallica to be?
Oh, boy. I wanted it to be freedom from school, from work, from the typical music that we were hearing. But really, it was music was somewhat of an escape for me that turned into a really great gift eventually. But it was a way to get away from my screwed up family.
What was screwed up about your family?
No one really communicated very well. It was very insular, very somewhat elitist in our religion. That's what they believe, but we believe this, which is better. You know, which is Christian Science. I grew up in that type of atmosphere. And I never really understood it either. So I felt very alienated from the outside world and from my family. So it was a connection, music for me was. But Metallica, when we hooked up, we were just passionate and loved music. And it was the soundtrack for our lives, you know, that it spoke for us.
And how old were you when the band started?
Let's see. Fresh out of high school, so 18 or 19, we started.
So no college?
No. We had college on the road, basically. Street college.
So you said that music was also an escape from work. Was this an escape from the work that you would have been doing had you not been in a band, or were you already working?
Well, I was working, and my dad left a note saying he was leaving at age 13. Never really said goodbye. my mom passed away at 16. I went and lived with my older brother, and she left some inheritance for me, but it was really, it was so tough to even want to touch that. It was like that was still mom. I didn't want to mess with that. So I went and I got a job working at a high school, moving a high school. Then it was custodial work. Then I went working in a factory because I had the long hair. That was pretty much all I could get. And, oh, it was so frustrating just sitting there. It was okay. I at lunch would go out and write in my truck, write some songs. But I remember seeing this this older guy working as the foreman. You know, he one day you'll be foreman. You know, ooh joy. You know, and he's 40, 50 years old, and it's like, man, I cannot do this. I have to play music. That was in me. I knew it had to happen.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Hetfield, one of the founders of Metallica, and there's a new Metallica book called So What? The Good, the Mad, and the Ugly. Now, I don't think you ever got into the kind of Spinal Tap type of show busy, you know, heavy metal stuff with the breastplates and the cod pieces. And, right. I mean, you never were into that, right?
Well, under my jeans.
Under your jeans, yes.
Well, we did some tours
with
bands.
Like T-shirts and jeans.
Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, we would walk on stage and play with what was comfortable, you know, wearing a spiked wristband with, you know, with nails sticking out of it. Didn't, you know, you really couldn't wipe your forehead off with that, you know. It wasn't comfortable. You know, at the end of the day, we wanted to be, you know, just us. And, you know, we had done some tours with bands. And growing up in L.A., it was kind of everywhere. And that was a little bit tried to sneak in, you know. I had bullet belts, you know, because Lemmy from Motorhead had that. That was the extent of our dressing up, you know. But you didn't really have to dress up and do things like that to be Spinal Tap. There are Spinal Tap moments that happen all the time.
Oh, tell me one. Tell me a great Spinal Tap.
Oh, landing in the wrong airport, you know, or, you know, saying the wrong city that you're in or something like that, or, you know. There's always something that happens out there that people make fun of that and you're living it. And it's not so funny when it's going on, but, you know, those moments do happen.
Did you have your destructive period of destroying hotel rooms? And
oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. A lot of our early lyrics were all about that, you know, on the road, show up in a city, rape, pillage, move on, you know.
Now, what's your explanation for why you wanted to do that?
Oh. Because I guess we could. Because I guess we were angry. We needed attention. And partly because you were supposed to, you know. We'd heard about, you know, the decadence of the 70s bands, you know, going in. And they had orgies. They had, you know, they were throwing TVs out of, you know, you heard all those stories. And we didn't really throw any TVs out of windows. But we jumped out of windows into pools, breaking bones, you know, setting off hotel alarms and at 4 a.m. and having to pay for everyone's room, you know, things like that, you know, kicking holes in walls, whatever, all kinds of just, you know, kind of releases. And after a while, it became a trap. You know, you're on tour paying for your destruction, you know, and you're not bringing any money home. So
did you enjoy it? Did you enjoy destroying things?
There was something about it. And it tied in with my anger a lot. And I had a lot of anger and rage problems that would just overcome me. And I would, whatever was near, I'd throw it and it would break. And it was just this adolescence that stuck with me, you know. And, you know, when I finally started, dating my wife-to-be, who is my wife now, Francesca, she, you know, it was embarrassing. It was embarrassing to myself and to her, and she helped me grow up quite a bit. But yeah, there was something about smashing stuff that just felt right. It felt good.
Looking back, do you think it's a healthy thing to have the liberty of acting out rage in such a flamboyant public kind of way? And people, you know, a lot of fans really go for that because there's something so mythic about the guys who have the guts and the money to be able to, like, destroy things on a whim like that.
Well, I certainly don't think it's healthy. There's plenty of other ways to get your anger out, and I didn't know them. I didn't know those tools. My survival technique was bottle up my anger, because I couldn't talk about it. I was fearful of it. I was afraid that no one could relate to it. You know, already feeling like an outsider, that if I told people this, they would just lock me up or something. So just keeping it bottled in, and usually it took a bottle to get it out. I'd be drinking, and then somehow something would smash or I'd hurt someone. And a lot of it was just a survival technique that I learned as a kid. I remember the first time that someone looked at me scared. When I was a kid, my mom, we had some friends over, and I was trying to hammer a nail into something, and it was too loose, and it wouldn't go in. And I had this hammer, and I kept smashing it, smashing it. I was like maybe 6 years old. And my mom said, Joey, that was my friend, said, come over here. Come over and stand by me. It's like, they think I'm dangerous. Maybe I am. That was the first time my mom looked at me really scared.
Was that empowering to you, or did it scare you about yourself?
It was both. It was a little both. Like, wow.
Uh-huh.
You know, now I've got something over her. But also, yeah, this gets attention too.
My guest is James Hetfield, co-founder of the band Metallica. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer and guitarist James Hetfield, co-founder of Metallica. A new book about the band has just been published called So What? When we left off, we were talking about breaking up hotel rooms and acting out feelings of anger that date back to his childhood. Do you think that anger worked for you musically?
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
I do now.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, we didn't analyze anything. It was just going for... it was going with the heart is what we called it, you know. It was whatever was coming out at the time. You know, I can't change what has happened, you know. Everything that has happened in our career, you know, as far as angry lyrics or whatever it was coming out subliminally even, that happened for a reason. It all happened for a reason for us to get where we are now, to realize, wow, that we were very... very immature in a way, but writing about it, you know, not knowing how to grow up or how to change your survival techniques or your tools in life, how to relate to people. And, you know, it took the band almost breaking up to realize a lot of things. And one was our form of expression, what a gift we have in that. And, you know, after getting clean and sober, going back and reading a lot of the lyrics, going, wow, that's pretty intense. And I can't believe there's some fans out there that really like this, you know?
Give me an example of what you're thinking.
Oh, well, something like A Dyer's Eve. This is a song about my parents and how they kept me in a cocoon, you know, not allowing me to see the world or what different religions there were or different kinds of people or, you know, for me, learning about other things was not... They were trying to keep me in almost like a cult type mm-hmm. of religion, mm-hmm. it felt like to me. And this song talks about, you know, now that you're gone, I'm out here in the world and lost, and I'm scared, and, you know, I blame you completely. And a lot of blame put onto my parents, you know, at that point. And it's pretty heavy stuff when I read it now. And, you know, but I realized my parents were doing the best they could with what they had to work with, you know. I didn't realize the trickle-down effect from their parents, you know. You know, you look at your parents as they're gods in a way, you know. They could never do wrong, you know. But looking back and realizing that, yeah, they made some mistakes, but they did the best they could. And let me sort out those mistakes and try and not repeat them.
Well, why don't we hear that song? This is Metallica.
Dear mother, dear father, what is this hell you have put me through? Believe a deceiver, day in, day out, live my life through you. Pushed under me, what's wrong or right? Hidden from this thing that they call life.
That's Metallica, and my guest is one of the founders, James Hetfield, guitarist and vocalist. And there's, by the way, also a new Metallica book, which is called So What? So, okay, so that song speaks a bit about your parents. You know, your mother's dad, your father's still alive?
No, he's passed away. He passed away about 12 years ago or so.
Did you write this before he died, or?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What did he think when he heard it?
I don't know, and I really didn't care. Uh-huh. We didn't connect again for a long time.
Right.
And it was somewhat difficult trying to figure out, what is this relationship? What is it? Am I supposed to hate him still? You know, he's my dad. I love him, but, dude, I mean, you screwed us over. You left, took all our money, enough that my mom couldn't survive, and she worried herself sick and eventually died and kind of was left hanging. And a lot of the stuff I was mad about was really him not teaching me how to be a man or a boy or whatever it was. And I had to figure it all out by myself, I felt, you know, and I wasn't ready for it. But I worked a lot of that anger out and some therapy things, which was really helpful. But yeah, you know, our relationship was very strange. After he left, it devastated me, you know. Well, he came back probably 6 months or to a year later, and he was, you know, he was midlife crisis dad, you know, had the stingray and the funky haircut. He shaved, and who's this guy, you know, bringing me gifts from Europe, you know, and Hawaii, and meanwhile, we're struggling, you know.
Right.
And tried to shower us with, you know, gifts for love back, and I didn't take it. My sister instantly accepted him back, and I was not having it. So we had a strange relationship. Eventually, got to be somewhat friends again, but it was never resolved. The stuff wasn't never resolved.
Was the music that you loved something you weren't supposed to listen to, as far as your parents were concerned? Were there, like, religious reasons for not being supposed to listen to the music you love?
No. My mom was, it was quite bizarre. I see it in my marriage as well. Our you know, the opposites attract, you mm-hmm. know. I'm somewhat of this, you know, kind of rebellious, unplanned character, and my wife is very organized, extremely moral, has a lot of that I was craving, and, you know, we're a good balance. And in my parents, it was quite like that too, though. My dad was very strict, extremely strict, and mom was out there, very liberal, very, you know, she was letting us express our art, and so she really helped it along. She encouraged it, and dad was kind of just, he didn't say much about it, you know.
The movie about Metallica, Some Kind of Monster, is an unusual kind of rock, you know, music documentary. It's not only the band, you know, kind of introspecting out loud about what's gone wrong with the band, about your relationships with each other. I mean, there's a therapist that you hire, who usually works with sports teams, I think, to come in and talk with you and kind of help you all figure out what's going on and what you should do. Now that the movie has been out and a lot of people have seen it, a lot of your fans have seen it, they've seen a side of you and other members of the band that they probably didn't know. What has it changed in terms of, like, your public image or your relationship with your fans, how they see you?
Well, I sum it up as in, you get back whatever you put out. And I truly believe that. And, you know, a lot of times we're putting out some pretty negative stuff, very cynical, and we were getting that back. And now putting out some of our real fears, our vulnerabilities, our weaknesses, and putting them out there. And we're getting a lot of that back. We're getting people that relate to the human side and not just the fantasy side of, oh, he's up on stage, he's on a pedestal, he's an idol of sorts, and this and that. And
can you compare the difference?
Oh, yeah.
In fan reactions?
Uh-huh, yeah. But also, I enjoy being a source of inspiration for the real me,
right,
you know,
right.
There's no doubt about that. There was a lot of energy put into the onstage me, which, you know, I love that me too, and that's the me I kind of want to be. But I'm incorporating a lot of the real me up there, which is great. I can go up there and say, hey, everyone, how you doing? I feel like crap, and I'm feeling better now, though, that I'm up here. And just being real with the situation, and, man, that diffuses all kinds of fear and just anxiety about just being alive for me. But before the shows, we have something we call a meet and greet, and there's usually the fan club members that get picked out of a hat or somehow they there's about 15 to 20 of them that come backstage before the show, and we actually get to talk with them, and it's amazing the different reactions we get. You know, there's your typical dude, you know, high-fiving guys, and then there's other people that are, you know, my dad struggled with alcohol, and I'm so glad. I'm proud of you for doing this. And they relate on different levels, and it's great to have access to all of that.
James Hetfield is the co-founder of Metallica. There's a new book about the band called So What. Hetfield will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Mark Summers' new illustrated edition of poems and tales by Edgar Allan Poe, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Warner Home Video, presenting the four-disc collector's edition of Gone with the Wind, including a reproduction of the 1939 souvenir program. And from Harcourt, publishers of Michel Faber's The Courage Consort, three novellas by the author of The Crimson Petal and The White. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews new collections of music from Bollywood. Also, James Hetfield talks more about his life with Metallica.
नजर के सामने जिगर के पास नजर के सामने जिगर के पास कोई रहता है वो हो तुम
नजर के सामने जिगर के पास नजर के सामने जिगर के पास कोई रहता है वो हो तुम
नजर के सामने जिगर के पास
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with James Hetfield, co-founder of Metallica. This metal band is still going strong after 23 years. A critically acclaimed documentary about the band called Some Kind of Monster opened in theaters over the summer and will be released on DVD in January. A new Metallica scrapbook has just been published called So What? The Good, the Mad, and the Ugly. When we left off, Hetfield was talking about who he really is versus the onstage version of himself, and how his fans relate to him now that the more vulnerable side of the band was revealed in the documentary. You know what I find interesting? Like, the kind of fan who relates to, like, the persona that you created, like the mythic version of yourself, the onstage version of yourself, and they're trying to model themselves on somebody who you're not even. Do you know what I mean? It's like, this is something like you created. It works really well on stage, but it's not what you are off stage, and they're trying to be that onstage person.
Yeah, it is. It is quite a strange cycle, and you know, for me, there are parts of me on the stage that are certainly me. There's somewhat of a hat or jacket that you put on
to go up
and perform. We're performers. But with a real heart. And, you know, it's all really about the music. But when fans come to see you play, they want to see something. You can't just stand there and play. You could, but it's not as entertaining as running around or showing on your face some of the anger of a song or some of the sadness on a song or some of the thing. It is performing. And then when they meet you at the airport, you're waiting for your bags and, you know, they come up to you, hi, how's it going? And you're, you know, kind of tired from a flight and you're shaking hands and they're like, wow, you're not what I thought you were. And instantly, it's like, why do I feel depressed about that, you know? So you think I should jump on the turn wheel and like smash some bags or what should I do, you know? And I'm not going to do that, you know. It's, you know, yeah, this is me and maybe I'm in a crabby mood, so go away or, you know, whatever it may be. Or, hey, I'm in a great mood. Come over here. Let's take a picture. And, you know, it's subjective to moods at times. But when people get disappointed for meeting you, that's so strange. But I've owned what part is mine and what is theirs because, you know, they've got something built up in their head that they need for their life.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not that they meet, they're disappointed in what they've built up for themselves. And sometimes that's a tough reality check. And, you know, so I leave that with them. But I also am nice and say, hey, you know, this is another part of me. And, yeah, like you mentioned in this movie, this is the extreme other part of us. There's the giant, mighty Metallica, indestructible on stage. And then there's this broken, lost, confused, fighting, struggling Metallica.
And there's two different James Hetfields in the movie, too. There's the pre-rehab and post-rehab version of you.
Prehab.
Prehab, yeah.
But well, I like to reside in the middle somewhere. That's the challenge, you know, somewhere in the middle. Because that movie was, it just captured us at such a time. And what a great gift the movie was. Not scripted. We had no idea that was going to happen. We're rolling cameras and, you know, things start happening.
You're talking about when you walked out?
Well, any of that.
Oh, right. Yeah.
They were filming us making the record. And then some, all of our shells started cracking and inner stuff from childhood and everything started coming out in front of the cameras. And we did not care who was there or what was there. It was flowing and it felt right.
Why didn't you care? Why weren't you self-conscious about this being recorded?
Oh, I was. There's plenty of parts in the movie where I'm just saying, get this camera out of here. You know, why is this? And I felt that it was hindering my recovery, you know. But I had to check it out, you know. I'm really glad it was all filmed because that's one of the best gifts that I could have in my life to go back and visit some of that. See yourself in a completely childish moment or a really articulate moment, mm-hmm, or a scared moment, you're crying or whatever it is, seeing yourself on film, but having the other people around you and going to a theater, watch people reacting to you doing that.
Right.
Like, wow.
What do you think about when you watch yourself in the first part of the movie and you're getting really angry with the bass player because he's forming his own band and you kind of like resent that? And this is the prehab period. What do you think watching yourself, you know, in that frame of mind and being like really angry and resentful?
Well, part of me is embarrassed for it. Part of me realizes that those were my tools. That's what I had,
mm-hmm,
from childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want people to leave me. Don't go. If he finds something better somewhere else.
Right.
He finds something somewhere else, he might like it better. And I don't want another family to disintegrate, you know. So I was gonna do everything I could to, you know, choke things.
Had you already made that connection, or did the therapist make you help that connection?
No, I didn't until later. Uh-huh. And it made total sense.
Right. Was it you who figured that out, or the therapist who got you there? Or?
I think we discovered it together. Uh-huh. I think, you know, a good therapist lets you discover the things,
because
it's very, very cathartic when you do it, of course.
Right.
But other times, you know, they've got to help pound it in there. But I think rehab helped a lot.
So this moment in the documentary where you're really angry, you walk out, mm-hmm. and then you're going to rehab and you don't come back for 11 months later. When you walked out of the room, did you know that you were headed to rehab after that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's somewhat deceiving in the movie that, you know, I slammed that door. You know, Bob came out and we had a talk. You know, eventually I came back another time and I talked about how things weren't going well at home, how I'd got thrown out of the house. And a lot of that revolved around that and how things in the band weren't going well or at home. And just, wow, how lost I felt. My whole world was shaking under me. You know, all of the roots, the foundations that I felt I had in my life. And I came back and I talked to them that, hey, I've you know, after so-and-so date, I have to go away. I have to work on myself.
Right.
And they knew I couldn't just leave. You know, that was not right. But it was discussed.
Mm-hmm.
And I told
mm-hmm.
them, you know, I don't know how long it's going to be, and I don't know. You're going to have to trust me on this. I just know I have to go and just, you know, I have to rebuild my life. I have to strip down. I had no idea what was in store for me, really. But I knew I had to get some help.
Were you like a star in the rehab unit?
That was the hugest fear out of everything.
What, that you'd be or that you'd not be?
That I would be.
Mm-hmm.
That, and it's so silly now to think about it. But at that time, you know, for me, the biggest fear was, you know, I had tried therapy before and to stop drinking and my just destructive behaviors. I wasn't really ready for it. And I thought, well, that doesn't really work for me. And then check, you know, my wife says, you got to check yourself in somewhere. You got to go to a hospital or rehab or something. It's like, no way. Don't you know who I am, kind of thing? You know, I wouldn't get real treatment there. You know, I couldn't do that. And my fear was that I couldn't. There was no help for me. And I was, of course, creating that fear for myself to continue my behavior, you know. But when I went there, I checked in under a different name, did all that stuff, you know, had the tag on that said, hi, my name is Frank, blah, blah, whatever it was. And at the first meeting they had in there, people went around the room saying their names and what, you know, was going on in their lives. And I just said, you know what, my name's James and I got a fake tag on and this is crap and I'm here to get some help and I'm fearful of this and this and this. And I broke down crying, and I told people my fears, and man, they were just right behind me saying, don't worry about it, you know, you're human. We're all humans in here struggling, and that right then, I knew I was in the right place.
My guest is guitarist, singer, and songwriter James Hetfield, co-founder of Metallica. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is guitarist, singer, and songwriter James Hetfield, co-founder of Metallica. There's a new book about the band called So What. Whose idea in the band was it to actually hire a therapist and have the band work through its issues like a couple might go to a marriage counselor?
It pretty much is a marriage counselor. Well, Mr. Toll, he was a therapist. He didn't have a therapist license. He was an enhancement coach, which was, you know, another form of, you know, attitude adjustment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But basically that told us that he could give feedback, you know, and eventually it was tough to kind of just find the boundary of friend and, you know, whatever hired coach. Mm-hmm. But he came on board when management Q Prime called and said, "What do you think about this?" You know, he's worked with another one of our acts, and we got to get talking. You know, because that was the big deal. There was no communication. You know, over the years of this machine of Metallica rolling on, we discovered that, say, a band like a Guns N' Roses, they're in each other's face. They're very vocal about their attitudes, their thinking, their feelings. We said, we can't do that. You know, look at them. And they eventually break up. So we're not going to do that. So we shut up for years and years and years. And that was self-destructive as well. We had to communicate. So we got this guy, Phil Toll, to come in. He was like a mediator in a way. He kind of made the room safe, neutralized the room. So helped us talk to each other because there was a lot of diffusing of bombs in the early days. So much baggage, tons, heavy stuff from years and years, a resentment that had just crushed our creativity and our friendships.
Some of the resentment was directed at you for being, you know, too controlling and for not allowing other people's creativity to surface in the way that yours could in the band. Was that news to you? Were you aware of those feelings before?
No, not really. You know, being the controlling person, I thought I was just doing what I was supposed to do. But really, it was a lot of insecurity, you know. I'm afraid that if I'm not the creative guy, what use am I here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that had a lot to do with me, me projecting that onto other people. You know, why are you here? You know, if you don't serve a purpose, see you later. You know, it's kind of the radar, the fame radar goes up. You know, you know, are you a friend of mine? No, what do you got to offer? Go away. You know, that kind of attitude. And I was putting that out myself. So I was afraid that if I wasn't creative, I'd be gone.
Was there something that the therapist actually helped you understand about the relationship of the members of the band that you don't think would have emerged without him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, when he brought up the word ego, I looked at Lars. He looked at me, you know. And then we had to look at each other, ourselves, you know. Right. We had to look in the mirror. Like, okay, yeah, all right. I'll own a little bit of that. And eventually it's like, yeah, you know what? We've both driven each other to certain just egotistical giants, you know. And thank God Kirk, you know, was such the referee through life, you know. And Jason obviously didn't fit in because he was like the minor ego, you know. And it was out of balance, you know, it seemed like. But yeah, that was a shock somewhat. And yeah, you know, I brought up the words, you know, ogre or intimidator, you know, and how I hated being that person. I want to have friends. Why don't I have friends? And they're telling me, well, you're like this. It's like, well, no, I'm not. I don't want to be that. How do I not be that? And that's when I realized that was a tool I brought with me since childhood, you know. Intimidate, man, my dad was pretty darn good at that. He'd just shoot a look, and that was all. That's all you needed to know. And that, you know, it was such a great tool to not have to get to know people, you know. I didn't have to get friendly with anyone. Intimacy was so scary, and it still is, you know. It get so close to someone, what if they leave? I would be crushed, you know. It's like the amount of love that you give, to me, equated the amount of hurt when they left, you know, and I still struggle with that.
So when you're on stage now, do you feel like you have a different stage persona than you did in the era before the movie, before Rehab?
Definitely.
What's different?
Well, touring itself is different. There's a mission, and that mission is that 2.5 hours on the stage and meeting people beforehand. But as far as being on the stage and being able to look people in the eye and feel like, you know, we're equal, we are I don't have any shame about all the behavior I've been doing out here. I'm clean with that. We're here to express some joy for life. And yeah, we are here. We're alive. We're able to yell and scream and connect through lyrics. And you're not alone. And I feel that too. And it's really great to be able to get up there. And that's the part I'm going to miss most, being off the road. It's almost like a drug in a way.
Being on the road is like a drug?
Well, being on the stage and getting that feeling of being loved, you know? And obviously I have people at home that love me, but there's something that's there. There's something that's just intoxicating on the stage that you can change people's attitudes, you know? You can make them smile up there, and it's so cool. It was never like that before, never.
No, when you're performing to an audience, I mean, the audience might all be like, you know, swaying their arms in motion, or, you know, the crowd becomes like an organism. Mm-hmm. If you were in the audience for a band you love, do you think you would be part of that organism, or do you think you'd be more hanging out on the periphery?
I'd be the outsider. And I always felt that way, though. And there is some comfort in that, but actually, there was a moment on stage about a week ago where I felt sorry for myself, because there was, during the song we have called Nothing Else Matters, there was a guy and his girlfriend and his buddy, a male buddy, and they were all arm in arm kind of rocking back and forth. And I'm going, you know what? I never had that. I never would have done that. And look, they're smiling. They're enjoying a moment together. There's no jealousy. There's no competition. There's no whatever stuff in between them. Look at them. I was living through them vicariously for a moment there, and it was really cool.
I want to read you something. This is from the BBC News Service, and it's headlined, "Heavy metal music and popular American children's songs are being used by U.S. interrogators to break the will of their captives in Iraq." Okay, so let me read some more. "Uncooperative prisoners are being exposed for prolonged periods to tracks by rock group Metallica and music from children's TV programs Sesame Street and Barney in the hope of making them talk. The U.S.'s psychological operations company said the aim was to break a prisoner's resistance through sleep deprivation and playing music that was culturally offensive to them. Sergeant Mark Hatzel of psychological operations told Newsweek magazine, "These people haven't heard heavy metal. They can't take it. If you play it for 24 hours, your brain and body functions start to slide. Your train of thought slows down and your will is broken. That's when we come in and talk to them." Our producer, Amy Salad, found this, and I had to read it to you. What do you think hearing that?
Yeah, there's many things that go through my mind. First of all, I mean, I want to make light of it, you know, instantly, like, you know, we have nothing to do with the war and all of this. And I was like, I don't have to defend that. You know, we make our music. It goes out there. Whatever's done with it is kind of done with it. We have no control over that. There's another part of me that wants to joke about it that says, we've been punishing our parents, our wives, our loved ones with this music forever. Why should the Iraqis or whoever it is be any different? And also, there's a pride also that, you know, it's culturally offensive to them, freedom, you know. The lyrics, for me, are a form of expression and a freedom to express my insanity. And boy, if they're not used to freedom, I'm glad to be a part of the exposure. But I really know the reason is the relentlessness of the music. It's completely relentless. And for to break someone that's not used to that, yeah. I mean, if I listen to like a death metal band, you know, for 12 hours in a row, I'd go insane. I'd tell you anything you wanted to know, you know? So.
Well, it's obviously, they didn't ask you for your permission.
No.
Not that I'd expect them to.
No, I wouldn't either. But you know, Sesame Street can be pretty annoying,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, can you imagine Barney and Metallica? What?
Awesome. Well, there's our next tour. There you go. In Iraq. That'd be awesome.
James Hetfield, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
James Hetfield is the co-founder of Metallica. There's a new book about the band called So What. The documentary about the band, Some Kind of Monster, will be released on DVD in January. Coming up, music critic Milo Miles reviews music from Bollywood. This is Fresh Air. Centered in Bombay, the Indian film industry so rivals that of the U.S. in worldwide popularity that it's known as Bollywood. A surprising development in the past few years is that the wilder types of Bollywood soundtracks have become popular with a Western audience that doesn't even know the films. These soundtracks mix and match diverse types of Western pop, from swing jazz to street funk to electro-techno. The ever-shifting blends are often topped with huge string sections and nasal, high-pitched female vocals. But as critic Milo Miles explains, Bollywood's appeal to Westerners makes sense.
Jaan pehchaan ho, jeena aasaan ho. Jaan pehchaan ho, jeena aasaan ho. Dil ko churane walo aankh na churao, naam to batao. Jaan pehchaan ho, jeena aasaan ho. Jaan pehchaan ho. जीना आसान हो दिल को चुराने वालों आंख न चुराओ नाम तो बताओ जान पहचान हो जीना आसान हो.
That music was the breakthrough moment for Bollywood soundtracks. It came at the start of the 2000 film Ghost World. Enid, an alienated teen desperate to neither fit in nor be cool, watches a video of a zany, frantic dance routine set to that number, Jaan Pehchaan Ho, and is transported. This is her music. It became one of the most talked about scenes in the film. Before that, Bollywood soundtracks, known as filmy, were mostly favored by international cinema buffs, world music specialists, and dance club fans who enjoyed techno remixes of filmy numbers. The selections that English journalist John Lewis made for the three-disc Beginner's Guide to Bollywood pinpoint what Enid found so seductive about the music. It's shamelessly in love with its own garishness and will embrace any style, any music segue, no matter how cheap or corny, if it's delightful. This is what so much American pop misses nowadays. If it's cheap and corny, it's usually safe and sentimental, not crazy and out of bounds. And if it's crazy and out of bounds, it's too angry or too cool to be playful. The rise of Bollywood music was foreshadowed a few years ago by the vogue for old blaxploitation movie soundtracks. In an era starved for sly but goofy dance music, Afro-American shoot-em-ups provided relief. But too many blaxploitation tunes are merely dumbed-down versions of more mainstream soul and funk. In parallel with blaxploitation flicks, Bollywood was turning out funky soundtracks that were more flipped out than dumbed down. Some outstanding examples appear on the second disc of Bollywood for Beginners. The following tune was later covered by the Kronos Quartet, no less. The Bollywood for Beginners anthology benefits from reflecting a single point of view, and it's bargain priced, too. Many other collections are mere gatherings of hits, some good, some dull, and nondescript filler tunes. Also, these collections could use more memorable titles, including the two I will recommend. The first is The Best of Bollywood, 15 classic hits from the Indian cinema, which has vibrant flow and a sense of humor. The other recommended anthology is The Very Best of Bollywood Songs 2, where you can tell why the selections were hits. It features the popular Mitwa from the crossover hit film Lagaan.
आ जा रे आ जा रे भले कितने लंबे हो रस्ते हो थक न तेरा ये तन हो आ जा रे सुन ले पुकार डगरिया रहना ये रस्ते तरसते हो तू आ जा रे इस धरती का है राजा तू ये बात जान ले तू कठिनाई से टकरा जा तू नहीं हार मान ले तू मितवा सुन मितवा तुझको क्या डर है रे ये धरती अपनी है अपना अंबर है रे अपना अंबर है रे तू आ जा रे
How long will the current fascination with Bollywood sounds last? Hard to tell with such a scavenger art form that depends on transforming styles from outside sources. The fad for Bollywood dance club remixes seems to be fading, though Indian youth in Britain remain a stronghold. What's certain is that the Bollywood film industry isn't going away at all, whether the West pays attention or not. Whatever they sound like, Bollywood soundtracks will remain among the most heard pop music in the world.
Milo Miles is a contributing writer to Rolling Stone. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberto Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
चलो चले मितवा इन ऊंची नीची राहों में तेरी प्यारी प्यारी बाहों में कहीं हम खो जाएं कभी नींद से जागे हम कभी फिर सो जाएं
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to learn about ways to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease on the web at alz.org, and from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Sickened, the true story of a lost childhood, a memoir by Munchausen by proxy survivor Julie Gregory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Edmund White. He's chronicled gay culture in his books of fiction, nonfiction, and biography. His new book, Arts and Letters, is a collection of essays. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.